Session number 216 47 rewind.
Bert Alexander, Re1. Where were you born, please?
Belfast.
Which year was this?
1925.
Did both your mother and father come from Belfast?
Yes.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Belfast?
No, I was 2 months old when I came to Trafford Park. So I went into St Anthony's School, which is a heritage centre now.
And how old were you when you finished there?
Well, actually, I left before 14 because the war was on. I was evacuated to Knutsford, but either the people got fed up with me or I got fed up with them. I can't remember, but we came back, my sister and I, after a fortnight, and the schools were closed down in Trafford Park, so I left school at the age of 13 years and 10 months. I should have stayed till November, you know, till November I would be 14 in November 39.
Have you got any memories of being evacuated to Knutsford?
Oh, yes, yes. Fighting with the children from Knutsford. You know, we descended upon them from Trafford Park to a nice rural area like Knutsford, and it didn't go down so well. So the conflict between the kids was great. I liked it.
Did they resent you?
Yes, they did, yeah.
What would they say to you?
Well, you townies, and you come from a dump like Trafford Park, which it was a bit of a dump, I must admit. But they're lovely people. Yeah. So that was, you know, kids are like, they'll fight the kids in the next street, aren't they? This is our street, that's your street. That was the type of thing. So I think they meant well when they evacuated the children, but I don't think it was a good thing to part children from the parents. Thinking back, it wasn't a good thing. They meant well. But we all had shelters. We had a shelter built in the backyard, about 2 foot thick. They had an escape part of it, about 3 foot square, tapered to the outside, so you could push it out if you were buried in. You know, right in the backyard of the terrace house. And we didn't have any electricity in there. We had a paraffin stove, a paraffin lamp. When the sirens went, we made a beeline for there. We had a flask of tea and coffee ready, sandwiches and blankets. And that's where we were the first night of the Blitz, the Manchester Blitz.
What was your address at that time?
1141 11th Street. I gave it to the chap.
1141
11th Street. They were named because the Americans built Trafford Park because Metropolitan Vickers was then the Westinghouse Brake Company, and they opened a site, bought a 50-acre site, and started the Westinghouse Brake Company. So they built the houses for where. That's why the streets were. There was no First Street, but there was Second, Third, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, no Seventh. The park and playing fields were Seven, Eighth Street, Ninth Street, Tenth Street, 11th Street, and 12th Street. And there was First Avenue, Second Avenue, Third Avenue, and Fourth Avenue. So American way. And so when I left school, you knew where you were going. Your pals were already working somewhere. The war had started. People could pick their own job, unless you were in a reserved occupation where you couldn't move. But teenagers, you could leave one job, and an hour later you'd find another job. You know, you just couldn't go short of work. There was so much work in Trafford Park. And then
what were the wages like?
Well, I was an apprentice, 9 and 6 months. What's that, 9 and 6 months? That's about 45p, 45p roughly, yeah. I think when I went to the Navy, I think I got a rise in pay. You can tell I was only, what did I get? 15 shillings, I think, in the Navy when I joined.
Is this a week?
A week, yeah. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day sometimes if you're at sea. At action stations all the time, 15 bob, loved every minute of it. But getting back to the Blitz, and the first night of the Blitz was the incendiaries. You've never seen fires like it. Round Trafford Park there was about 4 or 5 timber yards with huge stacks of timber. Frank Ross's was one of the main ones. And up and down the lines of timber were parked Canadian army trucks. Well, I'm assuming they were Canadian. The Yanks weren't in the war then. They hadn't been dragged in then. And left-hand drive. And those firemen never got the recognition they should have got. You know, I've seen some great fellas in the Navy and diving, jumping in water to pick survivors up, but those firemen, you know, it was the first dead man I'd seen. I worked at a place called Folkestone Bailey's that ran a fleet of vans. I was an apprentice auto electrician and mechanic, would be, you know. It'd been a great apprenticeship, it would have been. And I went round to see if the place was still there for the morning, for the next morning to start work. This would be about 1 a.m. And I went, it was only about 300 yards walk round through the streets. And I went there to the doors, and there was this fireman, all these firemen, you know, face back, and this poor fireman was lay on a stretcher with his tin hat on his chest, blackened face. I said, what's wrong with him? This bloke said, oh, he's dead, lad, he said, a machine gun on top of the ladder, you know, by the Germans when he was fighting the fire. But they couldn't train them to fight fires like that. They'd never seen fires like that. Even the regular firemen, and a lot of these were AFS, Auxiliary Fire Service. And I thought they were great blokes when I think back. Going up those bloody ladders, you know, with 50-foot flames and bloody German. Should be called the Royal Fire Service now for what they did, I think. Did some great work, those firemen. Well, in London, look how London was burning for ages. Those firemen, a tough job. So then, during the night, this incendiary fell in our house. It burnt itself out in the backyard. We doused it out with the sand. You know, everybody had to have a bucket of sand in the yard or in the house for this very reason, incendiaries. So I kept that. I don't know what made me keep it, you know, because they're all over the place. But I kept it, and I picked up the shrapnel. They had one gun defending Trafford Park, one AA gun, defending the most highly industrial area of its size in Europe, Trafford Park was. And it used to run up and down Moseley Road in Trafford Park, firing off a couple of rounds, and it'd move so the German plane couldn't pinpoint it. You know, they'd come down a machine gun if they did. So they'd run up and down about half a mile, say three-quarters of a mile Moseley Road, so they'd start at the top, they'd come down, fire a couple of shells, go to the end of the road, fire a couple of shells, and back up again. They'd stop at different parts, and they never hit a thing. Never hit a plane. Searchlights were there, the Jerry's used them as target practice. But then the next night was the HE night, was the explosive night. The first night, we reckoned, was the firebomb night, where everybody was burning. The next night, you could read the paper at midnight. You could read your paper. So you could read a newspaper at midnight. It was so bright, you know. And all the shelters were full of people. They had some good shelters. No, they wouldn't withstood a direct hit, but they weren't supposed to, but they'd protect you from any blast or anything like that. And then, so we were in the shelter the second night. This was Christmas, 40. And my mother said, I'd like a fresh cup of tea. So my dad said, well, I'll go and make one. I said, well, I'll come with you, you know. So we went into the house. Well, they're supposed to douse the fires. There was an air raid, and we hadn't done. We had three rooms, the kitchen, and two rooms downstairs. And there was a fire, only a small fire in each fireplace. So just as my dad was putting it, it was such a bloody bang. And the front door flew off, the windows came in, and the blast came down the chimney. So there was a shower of smoke and sparks all over the place, you know. Full of dust and smoke, and they'd bombed the Trafford Park Hotel. The bomb actually dropped on the bowling green of the Trafford Park Hotel, and we found one of the bowls in our upstairs window. You know, they had the bowls for the bowling green. They'd blasted everywhere, and we were right in line of the blast. And about 10 of the houses in 11th Street, the first 10 houses got the blast. A big crack down the hall wall, you know, and cracks here and there, so we had to move out eventually. We had to rehouse us.
About what stage of the war was that?
That was 1940, Christmas 1940, the Manchester Blitz. But no houses, you got a direct hit. We were hit with blast. It was the blast from the aerial mine or whatever it was that dropped next to the Trafford Park Hotel, and the blast all came our way. But to me, it was an adventure. You know, if it had been a parent with children, it'd been entirely different, you know. But I was young, what was I, when in 1940, so I was 16, you know. Like when I joined the Navy, just a big adventure to me. And then the next day, when I went to reported for work, the foreman said, "Oh, clear the gateway there, Bert, where that van is. There was a big double door had been blasted." He said, "Just clear the debris." And I found out a policeman had been killed there in the doorway, the blast from when it hit the club opposite, right next to where Marshall Stevens' cenotaph used to be. They've moved it down to the Wharf Road somewhere down there now. You know, the bloke who started Trafford Park Estates off. And in the, there was a bloke, a jawbone with teeth in. You know, it was this policeman and bits of other stuff. Oh, I said, just shovel it up in the sand and put it in the bin. That unnerved me a little bit too. I thought it was some guy's jawbone and just shoveled up. So what happened next? I say, it was a big adventure to me. There was nobody killed in the park, except the policeman. There's no residents killed in the park.
What do you think public morale was like generally in Manchester under the bombing?
Well, I don't, it'd be different for a man with a family or a woman with a family. You know, from my point of view, it was just a big adventure. But I would have thought, if now, like when I had three kids, if it happened when my kids were young, I'd been worried to death. I don't know. I'd have been worried to death. I certainly would. Anyway, I had a good apprenticeship. And I said, "This, I don't like this. I want to get in the Navy." So I tried to join up at 16. And I went. My mother said, "Listen, if you're going to mither me, I'll let you go, you know, under protest." So I had to go in front of a tribunal in Manchester, which was fair enough. Three chaps, the older chaps, probably my age, a lot younger than me now, they probably would be. And they explained that they'd need chaps like me when the war was over, that we'd have lost so many tradesmen and men that we'd be relying on people like me to be qualified tradesmen when the war was finished. And I said, "Well, I want to go in the Navy." That's why I went to go in the Navy. So they said, "We refuse you." So I went back to the work and I got fired. It was the only way I could do it. I got sacked.
What did you do?
Well, instead of wiring the vans up and that, I'd go wandering off somewhere and leave them. Mind you, what didn't help was the auto electrician, you know, they all had to stay in the jobs. He got another job somewhere with more money, I suppose. So there was nobody really there to train me. I could replace batteries and take the insides out of batteries and magnetos. Some of the trucks were running on magnetos. I'd service the magnetos and the dynamos and the starters. And I had one day a week where I went in the machine shop where I did milling and turning. I'd have been a cracking tradesman if I'd have stayed. I'd have known everything about. I mean, the mechanics then used to rebore their own engines. They had a boring bar. They bored the cylinders and made their own bearings. They weren't like now where they buy them off the shelf. They were proper mechanics, you know, lift the engine out. But I wanted to get in the Navy. So I got fired. So I got another job in the meantime. I was 17 in November. I think it was a Saturday. I was down at Dover Street, Manchester, where they recruited for the Navy on the Monday. And I said, "I've got my parents' permission." They said, "Well, yes. All right, see if you pass the medical." I passed the medical, top. My eyes were top. She said, "You've got marvellous eyesight." It made me an A-gunner later for that. That's the only reason why I could think of it. So I joined the Navy, December 42. And away I went to HMS Raleigh, near Plymouth. Near Devonport, is still there now, I think they still use it now, HMS Raleigh. Did my training there. Helped my first ship. I went past Warrington here with all the doors on the train locked, and issued us all with a pith helmet. You know, this what they for abroad. You know, the pith helmet. That's what it's to camouflage that where we're going. We're going up north. We're going to Scapa Flow, but we all got issued with a pith helmet and the top of your kit bag, so it could be seen. So as soon as we got up there, they took them all off us, like, because we weren't going to where it was hot. We wouldn't have had one of those anyway in the Navy. So I went on HMS Iron Duke, the old First World War battleship, and they gave me a month's gunnery training. I'm assuming because I had such good eyesight, you know, because they were very keen. Very, very keen indeed. If your eyes weren't top class, you know, you could become a gun layer or something like that, but not an AA gunner. You know, I had to have top class. So they told me. So I did about a month's training on Orlikans, and I went on an armed merchant cruiser, HMS Dunluce Castle. 700 tons of coal we had to load. It was a coal burner. You know anybody who in the Second World War was on a coal burning ship in the Royal Navy? I didn't. So I forget how long it was. The collier would come alongside, and we'd all swarm over it like pirates, with a band round here, for sweat band, and about 50 of us then loading these bags of coal. About 700 tons we used to load.
How exactly did you do it?
Into bags. The collier would come alongside, open the hatch, all the coal was shoveling bags. Hook about 10 of the bags in the derrick and whisk it onto the ship. They'd tip them down the hatches where the coal went, you know, back again.
So you were shoveling the coal into the sack?
Yeah, one time, yeah, and the next time I was emptying up the top, you know, so. I liked it, I loved every minute of it. And then we did the Russian convoys then.
Any details you can give about the kind of duties the Dunluce Castle engaged in?
Well, it was a supply ship, really. We'd get a submarine or two alongside of us, and we'd give them food and water, stuff like that. And I used to chat to them. So I went in the submarine. I could never have been in one of those. How they did that, I don't know. I do not know how they managed to live in those things. I just quit. I was going to get out of it. Just went up, just said, come over and have a look. No, I could never have stuck that under this. No.
Are you claustrophobic?
Well, not really, but that was something different. I mean, when we did our firefighting training at Scapa, they'd take you three floors down, a big ship, three floors down, there'd be drums of tar burning every so often. You know, thick smoke, and you had to find your way back from the bottom. That was your firefighting training.
Were you badly affected by
it? Didn't bother me at all. But the submarine, I'm not saying I was terrified, but I just thought I wouldn't like to have to fight a war from here. You know, and not many of them survived, really. Not many British submarines survived a war when you read it, the losses and that.
Did you go to sea in Dunluce Castle?
Yes, round the Scapa Flow. And then I picked up the Musketeer. And we went to Murmansk. And when we would get 20 miles... Well, we'd go to Iceland to pick up the convoy and straight across. When we got 20 miles out of Murmansk, the Russian fleet had come out to meet us with the sirens going and everything. And they had these old First World War destroyers the Yank flogged to us. We gave them to them with four funnels. Oh, bloody thing, always breaking down. We got rid of them to the Russians. And we gave them a battleship. And I'm sure it was the Royal Sovereign. And they renamed it the Archangel. But remember, because one of the officers said they've got three admirals on there. Somebody else said it's probably for the card school. You know, they need three, yeah, three admirals on it. This, the old Royal Sovereign was an old battleship then, a First World War battleship, I'm sure. It was like the Iron Duke was. The weather wasn't bad in the summer. It was nice. The weather was nice in the summer, the midnight sun, but we didn't like that. We didn't like the daylight, so much daylight. We'd rather have it all dark, really, you know. Excuse me.
Why didn't you not like the daylight?
Well, you could be seen, you know. You could be seen German aircraft, and we liked the rough seas that kept the U-boats away, you know.
What kind of a ship was Musketeer?
A destroyer, yeah. About 1,200 ton.
And what were your living conditions like in that ship?
Well, it was all hammocks. You slept over the mess deck. You know, your hammocks were slung. You had a mess deck that would take about 16 blocks, and your hammocks were slung up everywhere. They had rails, special rails up ahead, and the hammocks were all slung from there. And then when you finished, you tied your hammock up and stored it in a special area, you know, caged area. And woe betide anything you'd left on the mess deck when it was captain's rounds. Well, even though you're at war, and I've got to be spick and span. But there's one good thing I'll say about the Navy. We got good food. I'm sure we got better food than perhaps the lads in the Army got. We got good food.
What did it consist of?
Oh, we still get our coffee on a Sunday, but we can make our own. In a destroyer, you can make your own. You have your own cook. You designate one bloke to be a cook for that week. And he'd say, what shall we have? We'll have roast potatoes, we'll have some pork. And he'd take it up to the galley. He'd cook ours. Each mess, the bloke could cook their own. Not like on the Enterprise, the cruise I was on, where it's mess, you know, the mess in, you all got the same. You went and just got your stuff. But on the destroyer, you produced your own menu, depending on what there was to We do got beef, we got beef, we got pork. The breakfast was usually pilchards, which I liked. I liked pilchards, to be honest with you. But we did all right for food, yeah. We did all right for food. Yeah, I couldn't grumble about the food. And a great bunch of blokes. And the officers were, they weren't stuffed shirts, they were just like you, you know. They were just great blokes, no doubt. Ludwig Kennedy was a lieutenant on the Tartar, if I'm not mistaken. He was on the Tartar, a lovely ship, like the tribal class destroyers. Oh, I think nearly every one of them got sunk during the war. There was the Tartar, the Eskimo, the Huron. I think the Huron was the Canadian one, Canadian Navy. The Bedouin, all different tribes, you know. And he was on the Tartar. Whether he was on at that time, I don't know. I know he was on the Tartar when they sunk the Bismarck. Kennedy was.
And what was the background of the crew in the Musketeer? Did they come from all over?
All over, yeah. Mainly southern blokes, you know, because... But yeah, they were a mixed crew, Scottish, Irish, a lot. They got on very well, you know. Some of the blokes you met, they're just great fellas, you know. Great, the camaraderie was terrific. Oh, you never see anything like it, you know. There was one chap, I felt, and thinking back now, it must have been terrible for him. He had a wife and either two or three little girls. And he came from London. And they were getting bombed in London, more than anywhere else. He was on the Russian convoys. He was worrying to death about them. She'd be worrying about him. I sometimes wonder how they survive these things. And then when the bombing stopped, the V1s and V2s started up, and the south of England got most of them. There was one or two drops up near here in Manchester, one or two V2s. But London, I think it killed over 2,000 people in the London area, the V1s and the V2s did. And he'd be sat there with his picture of his wife and kids, you know. Well, it must have been terrible for him. And I think back now, to me, it was just a big, big lark, you know. It was a big adventure, but... I suppose he'd be a bloke about 25 then. I suppose it must have been awful for them, anybody with a wife and family back home, especially down south where they're getting the bombing, and especially London that got a real pasting from the V2s, the V1s and the V2s. I think it killed over 2,000, I'm sure it did. So he'd be worried to death. I don't know what happened to him when I left the Musketeer. It was some problem with it, and it was going to Rosyth for a repair, so they shipped us, you always go back to your barracks.
What had been your duties in Musketeer?
Lookout. Oh, you'd laugh on the lookout. I had two styes on my eye. Or two beauties. So I went to the medical officer. Got the oh, he said, we'll get them right. I said, what's your duties on this ship? I said, lookout. He said, Christ almighty, you're a lookout with an eye like that. I had two on one eye. He said, you're a lookout. I said, well, I've got another eye, you know, I can still see. Oh, so he took me off lookout. For a while, anyway. Anyway, then we went...
Whereabouts in the ship did you do lookout?
On the bridge, side of the bridge, in the lookout position. One each side of the bridge. You report everything you see. With your binoculars, you know.
And your action station?
Number two on the gun. To keep the ammunition lockers clear. No, you get ice on them up there. So with a chipping hammer, you just keep the flaps open with the... With the magazines for the Oerlikon, you know, I held about 62 rounds, I think. Like a big caterpillar, like that, rounded inside it was. And then the guy at the number one would fire off a couple of rounds every so often just to make sure the gun wasn't frozen anyway. But yeah, when it was cold, that was pretty cold, yeah.
Were you attacked by the enemy when you were in Musketeer?
Only with the Scharnhorst.
In the Musketeer?
Yeah.
Can you tell me the story of that in detail, please?
Well, I mean, it was 15 miles away, or 10 or 15 miles away. All I could tell you is it was about 15 or 20 degrees below. We got a straddle from this, I think it was the secondary armour in the Scharnhorst. I think it had 5.25s. Its top guns were 11-inch. It could fire farther than the Duke of York's 14-inch. That was the capital ship that was with us, the Duke of York. Well, there was the Norfolk, cruiser Norfolk. I think the Norfolk hit it first. There was the Norfolk. The Saumarez. Oh, it hit the Saumarez, the destroyer Saumarez. I think killed about 20 on the Saumarez. There was the Matchless. the Savage. Yeah, there was the Norfolk. There was about five cruisers.
Well, that's on record anyway. Don't worry about it. Just your own personal memory of the action.
That was it. And we glimpsed it once in the distance, that was all. You know, it's naval battles usually fought at 10, 15 miles away. The weather was, it was about 15 or 20 below. I know it was cold. A bit of a high sea was running, you know, so you're taking up more time making sure you didn't slip overboard or fall and break your leg, you know. It was the, I think, I'm trying to think which destroyer finished it off. Can't remember. But the Norfolk was the first to hit it before the Duke of York really hit it.
Were you told what had happened in the action?
We were told a few days later, and we were told we mustn't say anything in a letter back home until it had been announced on the radio. That we'd hear it on the radio, you wouldn't discuss it at all in your letters back home. We didn't tell you much now. Found out more afterwards than then. It was just one of those actions, you know what I mean? It was all, they were all pleased the Scharnhorst had gone down, especially the stories of when the Scharnhorst sunk the Glorious and the two destroyers that were escorting it. And, well, the story went round that they used the Glorious as a decoy because the King of Norway, they were transporting another cruiser about 100 miles to the north, and they left the Glorious and these two destroyers there because the Scharnhorst and another ship of the Germans, I don't know which it was, and they were taking King Haakon, I think, back to England. And there was a bit of a feeling at the time about it that they'd left the Glorious and the two destroyers to keep the Scharnhorst away from, I forget which ship it was he was on. They were bringing him to England. That's before I was in. That's before I went in. That was when the Scharnhorst sunk the Glorious, and I forget the two destroyers they were. But I know the Scharnhorst crew admired these destroyer men because they sailed right up to them and tried to get them with torpedoes, and they had no chance, you know, just blasted them out of the water. But that was why. So the feeling was running high. We were glad the Scharnhorst. But thinking back now, 2,000 young blokes like me went down, you know, it's bloody awful, isn't it? You know, it doesn't seem right. I think we lost about 800 off the Glorious and the two destroyers.
Did you see any men in the sea in the Scharnhorst action?
No, I didn't. Some of the others picked some up. They didn't pick many up, but when we heard the story, they left them because they said they were getting an Aztec sound, that there'd be a U-boat in the air. But we don't think there was. We think it was the Scharnhorst going down that gave them the ping back. They could have picked more up, but you know what I mean? You've got to think of yourself first. I mean, you're on a convoy, and if a ship got torpedoed, you couldn't stop and pick people up. You'd be a sitting target. Well, later in the war, about 10 or 15 miles behind the convoy, they had a special ship looking for survivors, came behind, looking, because you couldn't stop, especially if there was submarines in the area, if you're getting a ping back off from a U-boat, so you couldn't stop. Terrible for some of them, but to me, it was just a big adventure. Some of them married blokes with families, must have been terrible for the wives.
How many Arctic convoys did you do?
I think I did about seven.
Did you go ashore in Russia?
24 hours was all we'd allow us to go ashore in Archangel. And we went to Murmansk. We went to Archangel once, and we weren't allowed ashore at all. We didn't stay long anyway. But Murmansk, we were in there 24 hours, that was all.
And they couldn't
go outside the dockyard. You couldn't go outside the dockyard. That was it. You couldn't go outside the dockyard. So I don't know what it was like. Wouldn't allow you to. I don't know whether it was us or the Russians who didn't allow you to, but we couldn't go out the dockyard.
What could you see from the dockyard?
Nothing. There was a few buildings, a few log cabins, and we didn't want to see anything, to be honest with you. We wanted to get back on the ship and get out of there. We'd have these two-man subs and four-man subs, the ones that sunk did the Tirpitz. They practiced around Scapa Flow, and you'd be there and you'd see them going by, you know. I thought, I wouldn't like to be in one of those either. You know, some of them, there'd be one-man sub with a bloke up to here, you know, and with a snorkel mask on, so when he submerged, I thought, what a job. Oh, not for me. Oh, another thing, when we used to come in, the old German battleship was upside down there from the First World War. They scuppered it and it turned turtle. And the Navy built workshops on the bottom. So you'd be coming into Scapa-Flow and you'd see the flashes from the welding and cutting sets, because we had workshops on there. And the phosphor bronze screws, I think there was two or three of them, the big phosphor bronze propellers, were polished. And the sun used to flash on them, you know. Oh, we're not far enough, I can see that.